Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. This hour on the show, how can we live in accord with the resources of our planet Earth? Now, we know that we Americans use far more than our share of resources collectively, and we may be looking for ways to consume less in our own lives, less electricity, less petroleum, just for starters, fewer material goods in general. But beyond putting our recyclables out at the curb and beyond installing, let's say, low-flow shower heads and a few compact fluorescents, is there a more comprehensive way we can assess our consumption and live more simply and consume less? My guest this hour is Jim Merkel. He quit his job as a military engineer in 1989 after seeing a television news broadcast showing the results of the Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska. He saw the massive black oil slick, the ocean of crude-soaked cormorants, the crying seals. And he says when he saw the mess, he realized that he was the guilty one. He had flown 7 intercontinental flights in 1 year. He drove his car to work 3 miles every day. He realized he was the one who was polluting. So Jim Merkel began pedaling his bicycle to work. But that was just the beginning. We'll find out more about how Jim changed his life to make use of his resources in more modest and more sustainable ways, and in ways, in fact, beneficial to the whole planet, its people, its animals, its plants, the whole Earth. And we'll hear his advice about how we can move in that direction, too. Jim Merkel founded the Global Living Project to further his work. He conducts workshops around North America. In fact, he's going to be in Columbus this coming weekend. We'll find out more about that. My guest's current book is Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth, from Vermont this morning. Welcome, Jim Merkel. It's good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Fred.
And we're at 614-292-8513 if you'd like to join our conversation. And you can email a comment or a question to openline@wosu.org. So, Jim, you saw that horrible mess after the Valdez, and you began bicycling to work, but you've done a lot more than that. So how did you reduce your imprint on the planet Earth?
Well, some of the first steps were I basically locked myself in my house and got out my engineering economics textbooks and said, well, what do I, instead of asking how much more can I make, I asked myself, what do I really need? And that was a big shift for me, because then I realized, well, I lived in a pretty neat downtown area in California, San Luis Obispo, that I didn't need the car and I could take it off the road. So did that, and then I had 3 empty bedrooms in my house. Well, one room was for me, one was for the computer, one for the bicycles and the exercise machine, and one to meditate in, right? So
really?
I said, well, let me rent out 3 of these bedrooms, and I lived in one bedroom of the house, and I had 13 yard sales to get rid of stuff, and planted a vegetable garden. Now, you know, so in the last 18 years, well, at that point, I decided I could live on just the interest stream from what I saved by the age of 30 as an engineer. So I figured that out on my own. And so for 18 years now, I really haven't touched my capital. And I've been living from, you know, the interest stream of my savings for all these years. So
how much is that in a year?
Well, I live on about $5,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I've been able to do that in cities out in British Columbia in the mountains and now in Vermont and, you know, semi-ruralish areas around a college town. And you know, my spending did go up while I worked at Dartmouth College as their sustainability coordinator for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
because I became far too busy. And remember what it was, I had been 16 years without a paid employment, doing tons and tons of volunteer work, but things were more on my time, and I could adjust my schedule and make a schedule that could be bikeable or walkable or busable, and then when I was in charge of my own schedule, then it was not a problem at all. But once I got on someone else's schedule, it was harder. I would say I doubled my spending up to about $10,000 a year for 2 years, and then I left Dartmouth, and I'm getting it back down again.
So Jim, decreasing your spending and living on $5,000 a year, I mean, is that how does that impact less the planet Earth?
Well, every dollar we spend has got embodied energy in it. Every product, even if it's a service, takes energy to make or create the service. The buildings need to be heated. The buildings need to be built. All the things behind it, say the every little subcontractor to make a button for your shirt is out there, and they have insurance companies. They have executives flying to sell their buttons, and all that goes into one product, the shirt. And now if I spend less, I'm consuming less habitat, less water, less land, available land. I'm polluting less, I'm less toxics in the environment. So I look at it as every dollar you look at that's coming out of your wallet is going to do damage to the planet. And
That's kind of discouraging, isn't it?
Well, to me, it's very empowering because I don't really love spending money. I know the advertiser would love us to, but the thing about it is then I have to work to earn it. And then I'm on this complete rat race after a while. And I knew what it was like to the age of 30 because I, you know, having 30 yard sales, I had my, you know, my friend said, is this a multifamily yard sale? I said, no, this is me. Mm-hmm. Because I was just a typical over consumer. And that's, you know, so once I realized when I see like when someone hands me a paper napkin, that's a tree. I love trees. So why would I use a paper napkin? You know, I can bring my own cloth napkin. So there's a beautiful alternative that's even more elegant. So in the end, it didn't become discouraging. It became fun and beautiful and a new challenge. And actually, I've been loved it. It's been a really fun challenge.
Mm-hmm. So you have in Radical Simplicity as one of your tools something called ecological footprinting. And you have a number of dimensions upon which we can – I'm thinking that a lot of our listeners probably recycle. You know, a lot of our listeners probably have the compact fluorescence, et cetera. But you've got a much more comprehensive way of looking at it, huh?
Right. And what I ask people to do is – so the footprint itself, what it does is it sums up the program in my book. Will look at 100 different consumer items and services and give you an actual impact for doing that item. And so if you are to take this on and do it at the end of the week or month, you see how much is used around the world to get your bananas or to have that insurance policy, to get educated, to have fun at the nightclub, or, you know, to buy food mm-hmm. and pay your utility bills. So that adds up all those little patches around the earth needed to, say, forest to absorb the CO2 from you driving the car. The land area to grow the carrots and to grow the beef, it's all in there. So when you, at the end of the month, just put your monthly amounts in, it's a very simple system, mm-hmm. you are getting then a total footprint, how big of an earth area is needed to support you. And I'm not trying to browbeat people or tell them what they should do because I don't know their life. So my book is not 100 things to do to save the planet. What I ask you to do is look at your own, what you are doing, and then see how does it feel inside. Does it align with your own values?
Mm-hmm.
Do you get satisfaction from doing it? And then if you do, keep doing it. Maybe you want to add to your children's education because you'd get more satisfaction from seeing them, say, learn to play the bass or the piano. You might buy 4 CDs a month and say, well, I listen to them, and then they sit in a big stack, and I've got 1,000 of them, and that's 1,000 times $20 is a lot of money sitting there. I worked how many hours to get all those things? Each month I may work 6 hours to get my DVDs, and maybe I could spend 6 hours out, you know, in the garden or playing with my kids
sure.
or with my partner out on a fun hike or something. If the opportunity cost of buying that thing, in a sense, in economic terms, whenever you buy one thing, what you gave up was your lifetime that you could have spent in doing something maybe that was more fulfilling. Now, if you loved what you did, say you put you worked and put a lot of gas in the car, and that really gas felt great to sit in traffic and commute, maybe you'd keep doing it. But if you didn't like the commute, you'd change, maybe. So mm-hmm. what we find, this I took from Your Money or Your Life, the book, which we may talk a little more later, but, you know, they had this neat idea that if you just recognize what you're doing as an individual, no one telling you what to do, you just make note of it. So it's kind of being mindful, paying attention because you see it. And then at the end of the month, you aren't making a plan of how you're going to change. You're just noticing month after month, I'm not in alignment with how much money I spend on going out to lunch, maybe. The food is maybe not that good. I cook better at home. If I just got up a little earlier and made a little extra last night and packaged it up in a container, reusable container, and took it to work, I'd have a nicer lunch and I wouldn't be spending all that money.
And not only that, and you also, you'd probably have less impact in terms of resources in general, right?
Exactly.
Especially if you bought some of the foods at a locally grown farmer's market.
Right, right, because yeah. Then you're in the driver's seat. You know, when you go to a restaurant, you don't really know unless the restaurant really advertises that we are using local products. You know, the egg is probably going to be the cheapest egg you can get.
Mm-hmm.
That's from a chicken that lived in a 3/4 of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper area cage for its whole life, pumping eggs out. Versus if you went and saw your neighbor Betty, who has a few chickens in her backyard, and you saw how she treats her chickens. You know,
that wouldn't happen. It might happen in Vermont, but it wouldn't happen in Columbus.
Yeah.
But we can't go to a farmer's market anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway.
You might find in the co-op there's some local, you know, local-ish.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You have some, Jim Merkel is with us. He's the author of Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth, and Jim will be here this coming weekend, May 16th and 17th, for a conference called Sustainability Now, Strategies for Personal and Community Action. It's sponsored by Simply Living, by the Social Responsibility Initiative of the Ohio State University, and by the Columbus Green Building Forum. Jim, you're going to be speaking Friday night at 7 o'clock, and then there's a Saturday program all day. And in a minute, listeners, if you're interested in finding out how to register for either Jim's Friday night keynote address or the whole conference, I'm going to give you the world's most complicated website here. So I want a web address. So I want you to be able to get a pencil ready, but I'll give it to you right now. In just a moment. So have it ready, and we'll tell you how to get to this conference with Jim Merkel this weekend, sponsored by Simply Living and the Social Responsibility Initiative, OSU, Columbus Green Building Forum. Jim, you have a lot of very interesting questions in assessing my ecological footprint, like how often do you eat animal-based foods? And how much of the food that you eat is processed, packaged, and not locally grown? It's from more than 200 miles away. And you're saying animal-based foods and foods processed and packaged far away from here have a much greater impact than if I didn't eat so much animal foods and if I ate products closer to home, right?
Yeah. So for instance, beef has a 33 times larger ecological footprint than eating vegetable mm-hmm. or fruit. And if you just think about it, I'm a recovering engineer, so my mind thinks of weird things in weird ways, but why we change our light bulbs to compact fluorescent, because remember those old-fashioned Thomas Edison light bulbs that were so hot when you tried to unscrew them? Because we want light, not heat, and the heat is the waste energy. So just like a cow is a big, warm animal, and it's walking around all day, and we want food, not heat, and it's all its heat is warming up the area around it, but it's not giving us any benefits. So it metabolizes 24 hours a day when we can eat the plants from the area that it was grazing. So that inefficiency is about 33 times. So, you know, if we didn't have 6.5 billion people and growing on the earth, it maybe wouldn't matter so much, but we do. And so actually diet is it's the third or fourth largest impact item for the average person. And the people who are, you know, if you are a meat eater, that's probably going to be your biggest item is mm-hmm. the beef. If you go to chicken, it's about, you know, a quarter of that of beef as an example. So you can still be a meat eater, but I would say, you know, and doctors will kind of advise you to do this too, to stay away from the red meat. But,
And if you eat meat and animal products less often, you're going to be doing a favor for the environment. Yeah.
Less often is a great way to go.
Yeah.
You know, my mom over time, you know, I go home and I'm a vegetarian and almost vegan, but I eat whatever my mom puts in front of me. To me, it's a gift of love for her to do that. I'm not going to give her a lecture on vegetarianism at her age. But I've noticed her, she's read my book and then given it to probably 200 of her friends. You know, she's mm-hmm. one of my biggest fans in a sense. But she now is reducing her portion and eating it she's 78, and she'll eat, you know, a little portion and maybe two or three times a week. But, you know, it's really shifted for her.
Yeah. I think we sometimes don't think about it. Well, we do install the compact fluorescents and the low-flow shower heads and things like that. I don't think we really necessarily always think about our eating choices in terms of the impact on the planet, but they clearly make a huge difference.
Sure. And then getting local is really good because you can just imagine, in, you know, a carrot that comes from California, when, you know, Ohio can grow a fine carrot or a potato from Maine, and mm-hmm. you know, Ohio can grow a fine potato and apples and fruit and all these things that you can get local. So if I, you know, I became a real studier of labels and asking farmers, you know, not farmers, but say the co-op that I would shop in, the food co-op, where is this coming from? And then they all of a sudden started labeling it all, and they really... my friend, I ate asparagus yesterday, and at the co-op, the woman, my friend's mom told me, it said on the sign, it came from across the street. That's what the sign said at the co-op.
Right.
This is a co-op that really takes it seriously, and I don't know if the listeners know, but locavore, Webster's chooses a word every year that's their word of the year, and this year it was locavore, which is basically eating food that's grown locally from, say, a 100-mile radius. So it's a movement that's catching like wildfire. There's a chapter in every state right now in the nation that's groups who are getting together and having dinners and potlucks and challenging themselves to live for 2 months with food from the local area, and they get wild cards. You can have, say, 2 wild cards, which maybe will be your olive oil and coffee or whatever. I don't know, your things that come from out of the area. But it's a really neat movement.
Surely. We've got several farmers markets and a couple of food co-ops here. You got a very nice one up in Brattleboro there, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Big one. So another series of questions you had in terms of figuring out our ecological footprint. By the way, we're at 614-292-8513 if you'd like to join a conversation right now. Questions about our shelter, about how many people live in your household is one question. And then the size of your home, is it 2,500 square feet or larger, 1,500, 1,000 square feet? And how about using energy conservation and efficiency measures throughout your home? Do you do that, yes or no? So tell me about the number of people living in a household, the size of the house, and how that impacts on the environment.
Right. So if you say the total resources it takes to actually build a house, each square foot of housing is typically the second largest impact item for an American. Right behind our car would be number one. So the size of your house is bigger even than your utilities that are put through it. And, of course, if it's bigger per person, it's going to take more utilities. So if you share that house with one more person, you've just halved your footprint, ecological footprint, for your housing. So that's a pretty radical shift. And so if you put three people, say when I went from one in my four-bedroom house to four, I reduced my footprint to a quarter for my housing. And so in my book, I have these strategies. And, again, I give you this qualifier. I'm a recovering engineer, so I like things that are, you know, practical in a sense.
Yeah.
And so I say sharing, caring, and conserving are three major strategies that you can apply to many things. So if you share your house with one more person, you have it. Three people, you third it. Four, you quarter it. And the same goes for your car and your washer, your dryer, your refrigerator, your lawnmower, your rakes, your computer, everything. Now, if you care for it and make it last, say, twice as long by not leaving your bike out in the rain or, you know, putting a chain around your canoe just so it doesn't get lost, and then you make it last twice as long, you've halved its impact.
Mm-hmm.
If you keep good, you know, care of all the things you own, then if you get more efficient, say, appliances or cars, say your car gets double the miles per gallon, well, you've halved your impact. Now, if you use it twice as much because you feel so good about it, you'll have done nothing.
That's right.
You'll just erase, you know, your the thing that I argue against people who think efficiency only is that our behavior can erase efficiency very quickly. But say that you become very, very good at, say, making good lists, and you don't forget the milk, and you make hard choices like you have a friend 20 miles away and a friend that's, say, just around the block, and you can walk to their house, and they're equally nice, and you hadn't seen either one for a month, and so you make these really tough choices like seeing the one who's around the block, not forgetting the milk, and at the end of the month, you've traveled half as much.
Yeah. I mean, a big difference between somebody, let's say, has a hybrid car that gets very good gas mileage, and they take that, they travel 10,000 miles a year, but somebody has a car that's not quite so efficient, but they're only traveling 3,000 miles a year. There could be an equivalence there, so it does depend on use, does it not?
Yeah. So, you know, I like to say that with these three things, we can get our, say with a car, you put two people in it, use it half as much, and have twice the efficiency, twice the miles per gallon, you're to 1/8 the ecological footprint. That's radical.
Wow. Yeah.
And you haven't really done ecological heroics yet.
Ah, well, we're going to get to those heroics as we move along here, but this is good basic stuff. You don't have a car at all.
Well, I do have one now.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Tell me why.
Well, I was carless for 14 years. I moved back to the East Coast to be near my dad, who was getting very ill and old and needing support. So he did pass away 2 years ago. But living in New England, it was so cold in the winter compared to British Columbia. I mean, minus 30. And my mind said, I can't cycle in that cold temperature.
I would think not.
But 2 years ago, my friend lured me on a backpacking trip out to I blame it on my friend. Every year he would let me know about this great backpacking trip in the Gila in the southern New Mexico. And finally one year I caved in. I said, I want to go for this 10-day, 12-day backpack. But when I came home from it was in December. I said, okay, since I did that, I'm going to ride my bike through the next 2 winters. and to make up for my flight. And so I basically bought really good warm clothing, like boots from, you know, these mucklucks that you get from out Midwest there somewhere that are minus 60 rated. You know, really good warm clothing. And I got to work in minus 10 to Dartmouth for 2 full years. I rode almost every day. And, you know, so I actually can ride, but now I have gotten used to the car again.
Oh, my.
You know, when I do use it way less than most people, but in general, but I know the addiction. You know, it's so easy to just jump in and go.
So the addiction has overpowered you once again.
Oh, yeah. Well, so I'm constantly in a flux of, you know, getting lured in and then getting my forte up again and then, you know, going back again. It's not like an internal harsh struggle. I play with it. You know, I don't beat myself up
because sure.
I'm too old for that. I'm 50 years old, so I can't keep beating myself up or feeling guilty. But I notice things, and I notice how I feel inside. And yesterday, I did go to visit my mom's 78th birthday, and my family all got together, and it was, you know, a five-hour drive.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes, you really have to. You want to see your family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this summer I've gotten invites to weddings, family, you know, nieces, nephews, and weddings across the country, graduating from college, two weddings and one graduating from college, and then, you know, a couple getting engaged and a party and just constant. Like, I could do six trips right now that are major just to keep up with these types of things, which I would love to do every single one.
Absolutely.
Internally. And, you know, with just the way things are going, I mean, I just heard Dr. James Hansen speak down at, he's the climate scientist
yes.
for NASA, and I helped organize the conference that was in Washington, D.C., and I helped, you know, I was on a panel and I heard him speak and got to talk to him, and, you know, he's saying the 80% reduction by 2050 is not going to get us back to where we need to be.
80% reduction of greenhouse gas emissions.
Huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
He says that's not enough because he's seen that the carbon that's in the atmosphere already, you know, that we're experiencing was done years ago. So when it catches up to us, he's seen the models that he's working with and also the evidence is going fast. You know, what they're witnessing and measuring is faster than their predictions, in essence, the meltings.
But, you know, I think you should go to see all your friends and all of those things and the wedding, et cetera, because I wouldn't want to live simply and thereby reduce my contact with other human beings. I want to figure a way not to do that.
Well, I do agree. And I was living 3,000 miles from my family in British Columbia, 17 years out there. And we were teaching courses on radical simplicity. And one of the things we teach about is bioregionalism, which means living within your area, your bioregion. And I said, what's wrong with this picture? If I'm going to spend the next 50 years deciding, do I destroy the earth with my polluting or do I see my parents?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like not a good decision.
No.
So, I mean, I love British Columbia. Living in New England is, you know, if you look at the ecological systems, that's what I really am in love with, those big wild systems and having grizzly bears and wolverine and cougar in my backyard, which I don't have here. They've been exterminated 400 years ago. But I decided to buckle it up and move back, you know, to be with my dad as he was ill and not be flying back and forth every day. But now that I'm even in New England and all my family's in New England, I'm still getting far more invitations, you know, and things that are nice, but I'm starting to say I can't do them all. And then whenever I am gone, like I could be gone almost every single weekend off somewhere,
sure.
and I don't even know my neighbors hardly. They're nice people.
Mm-hmm.
And they teased me the other day, this the older couple, which are so nice. And they, you know, she says, go take eggs whenever you want them. Don't even ask, you know. But she teased me and she says, oh, you only come over here when you need something. And she was teasing. They poke me all the time. They're a really nice older couple. She gives me herbs from her garden and stuff I can transplant. And then I said, yeah, I kind of do that a bit, you know, because I'm too busy. And I drive by their house or ride my bike by their house or walk by their house almost every day, and I don't stop in to say hi, Betty, and hi, Doug. And they're in their late 70s, early 80s.
Hmm.
and I like them. They're nice. They just bring you right in the door every time you knock on it, you know.
Sure.
And so, you know, there's an opportunity cost there. You know, you can decide, okay, I'm going to travel less. I'm going to get to know Betty and Doug, and that's an elder couple, and when they start feeling a little ill, I'll go help them, and they need groceries. She'd be a neat kind of grandma, you know.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. We're going to pause here. Jim Merkel, my guest, Radical Simplicity, his book, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth. When we come back, we'll tell you how to go to the conference if you'd like. That Jim's going to be here in Columbus. Callers, hang right on the line. We're going to get right to you after we pause for these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was relatively unknown on the international stage before he was elected president of Iran in 2005, but his election marked the rise of a younger generation of right-wing Islamic hardliners intent on strengthening Iran's military power. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Khosra Naji about his biography of Ahmadinejad. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air will be here later this afternoon. It begins at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich, and it's 55 degrees at 10:32. Thanks for joining us for Open Line. Find out what's happening in your neighborhood on the WOSU events calendar. It's online at WOSU.org. Get information on interesting community and arts events, and even share and post information about events in your area. It's free and it's easy. Log on to the events calendar at WOSU.org. In the forecast for today, a beautiful day, sunny day with a high of 72. Clouds move in tonight, a low of 52 for tonight, and then rain is likely on Wednesday.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer. In partnership with the Nature Conservancy, Meijer is helping customers identify and select non-invasive plants for Ohio backyards. Information is available at nature.meijer.com.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. Jim Merkel, my guest this hour, his book Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth, and we're finding how we can live in accord with the resources of our planet Earth and in a really comprehensive way in our individual lives. And we're at 614-292-8513. You can email a question or comment to us at openline at WOSU.org. Now, just before we go to our callers here who've been patiently waiting, I want to go mention that Jim is in town here this coming weekend, May 16th and 17th, Friday and Saturday. Jim's got a keynote Friday evening, a Sustainability Now conference sponsored by Simply Living, by the Social Responsibility Initiative of the Ohio State University, and by the Columbus Green Building Forum. Here's where you can get information on registration for Jim's talk Friday or for the whole conference. Are you ready with your pencils? It's a long one. http://sri.osu.edu/sustainabilitynow/ I'll give that to you again. http://sri.osu.edu/sustainabilitynow/ And ending with a slash. Okay, we'll give that to you again. Let us go to our callers. And Anne is on the air. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, Jim, I really am so interested in what you have to say today. It's so odd that it came up now. I belong to an organization called SeniorNet on the Internet, and it's all seniors, of course. And I've been getting ready for a conversation called Curious Minds, which will cover organic living. This is where the title I picked. And in going to the internet and Googling all this stuff in, I have been able to find all kinds of not only international, clubs that not only do organic living, but they do slow cooking, they do sharing, they go to markets. It's just an amazing thing to me that you can find all this. In the process of looking for everything, I even found an MCL, which is kiddingly called by the seniors the Medicare Lounge, in Muncie, Indiana, which only uses fresh, locally grown organic food.
Uh-huh.
So I'm really tickled pink about your thing. I want to make a suggestion to you. Instead of reading out that long address on the internet, I think if you Google sustainability now, Columbus, Ohio, that you'll find that.
Great. That's a real help. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I'm so glad you're here, and I hope to get to your talk.
Thanks, Ann. Appreciate your call.
You bet.
And our next caller here is James. Hi, James.
Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I, like many Republicans, feel that the environmental movement is a kind of just a thinly a veil for the socialist and communist agenda. And quite honestly, I couldn't have picked a better person or a spokesperson to point to when I listen to the suggestions that that Jim makes.
Hmm.
If the way I look at it, this is America, if that's the way he wants to live, wonderful. I support that. My concern is this, that we're having politicians and we're filling our kids' brains with this leftist communist agenda that this is what is going to be dictated to us, okay? I mean, the way I look at it, if you want to blame someone for the high gas prices, you need to blame people like Jim, groups like the Sierra Club and Greenpeace that will not allow domestic drilling, will not have blocked ANWR, blocked everything we've tried to do, won't even let us build a refinery. That's having a real impact on people's daily lives. And, again, I don't mind his, you know, it is intriguing what he's talking about, but the problem is the radical left, of which he's certainly a part of, in my opinion, is trying to dictate how we live as Americans. Don't go visit your friends. Don't fly. Don't drive. I want to take your car away. I want to dictate to you how you're going to live. I find that utterly un-American, and that's why us on the right will fight this every step of the way. And I'm someone who buys organic food for the health benefits. I feed it to my daughter. But I have a real problem with the political undertones of being forced and being told what to do. And I'd like the caller's comment.
Okay, Jim, hang on the line.
Sure, yeah.
Jim Merkel,
no,
what do you think?
Well, I really appreciate your call because it's just so interesting because one thing I think you didn't hear was, but I did say it was in my book, I really asked you to ask yourself how much to consume. So I really didn't ever, in my whole book, if you read it, take the time to look at it, I don't tell you what to do. I ask you to make your own measurements, then ask yourself how it feels, and then make your own choice. But, you know, I'll just share this with you, though, the caller. I forgot your name.
James.
James, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, my parents are self-proclaimed right of Rush Limbaugh, as in, you know, they are really strong right politically. And now, I think I've learned more. In my book, you'll find more of their values in there than anything. And my dad, you know, he's a truck driver, construction worker. He was always strong enough to beat up his four sons at once. You know, he's a tough guy. Now, he basically said to me, you're responsible 100% for the impacts of your lifestyle. That's his right. His right conservative politics say you are responsible for what you do. So when, you know, he picks up the garbage up and down the road for a mile from either side of his house. So when I said to him, Dad, what are you doing to offset the pollution from your car? First he'd say, well, what are you doing? And, you know, and see, well, then he'd see I'm biking everywhere. So once he realized that I wasn't just a hot air balloon, he started bragging to all his friends that his son is riding his bike across the continent. Because his values are, so conservative values are conserving the earth originally. Now, they've been perverted into, like, creating wars and getting resources and being a bully. My dad's right-wing philosophy is if you're strong, you're the one who sticks up for the kid on the playground getting picked on. You don't become the bully. That was my dad's right-wing philosophy. So what I'm talking about in my book is how does anyone say be responsible for the implications of their actions? I'm not telling you how to do it. I'm giving you tools to measure it. But then you have to make the decision. I can't make a decision for you. There's nowhere in my book you're going to find me telling you or scolding you or making you feel bad about what you're doing. It's the most American thing you can do. And if you read it, I'd love to have a talk with you because I don't think you'll be so, you know, just first knee-jerk reaction I can understand. because we like to pigeonhole people. But I go home every time to see my parents who are ultra-right wing. And we don't argue and shout at each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are on the same page on this. My mom stitches patches on my dad's trousers. They're working class Republican all their life. They don't have extra money. They don't want to see gas prices $4 a gallon. They don't want to see $780 billion spent on war every year. They hate war. My dad was in the war. He hates war. You know, that's his values. He doesn't like it. He doesn't think we should be, you know, the largest arms dealer on the planet, bar none. Okay, we are the biggest arms dealer on the planet. He doesn't think we should be that. That's his Republican values.
Okay, let's go back to James for your comment. Hi. James, are you with us?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
I heard everything that he said, and again, of course, he steered it into the war, and we're warmongers and everything else. So once again, this is far beyond a knee-jerk reaction, as the many of the left-wingers like to say that that's all we do is we go off knee-jerk and we follow Rush Limbaugh. And I find that his advice is a typical liberal response. It's far more condescension. If driving to work gives you pleasure and spending all that money on gas and, well, then I guess go right ahead. You know, it's the typical, I'm a college professor, I ride my bike to work, I shop at a co-op. It's the traditional, stereotypical liberal, and that's fine. I have no problem with it. Live how you want to live. But where is this conference being held? At a college. They're trying to form the minds of the young kids who don't really understand things. And I'll leave you with remembering Al Gore flying by himself on a private jet. The hypocrisy of the environmental movement is there for you to see, and it's certainly there for you to see in your guests.
Well, James, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Fred. Appreciate it.
Okay. Jim Merkel is with us, the author of Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth. So, Jim, you urge us to make this self-assessment of how we are impacting the Earth. And that's got to do with the food we eat, how much animal food we eat, how much locally grown produce we eat, how often we use our car, how much we can double up or simply not use it at all, walk, bicycle, et cetera, et cetera. If we've got more than one person in a smaller house, that's just great as well. Anything else I'm overlooking here?
Well, I think, you know, those are some of the simple earlier ones that we can get into. And I think there's one aspect that I think is really useful to look into is people's own values, ethics, and also spiritual beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And because regardless of what different folks, you know, find as spiritual juice or medicine or whatever you want to call it for their own life, if you're Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, Native American, Earth, based religion, a lot of the religions now are realizing that part of their own teaching is to take care of, well, if you call it creation, whatever you call it, to care for the earth, to care for others is a primary core value. So, you know, taking care of your neighbor, being, you know, that being, you know, loving your enemy even, or taking care of the earth. So I think people connecting with that, I think often helps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, them make these choices that could be difficult easier and actually more enjoyable. So if you are feeling obligation is calling and you feel terrible because you feel guilty and obligated to, say, see your mom, when you go to see your mom, she's not going to be very happy because you feel guilty to, you know, you came to see her out of guilt. If you love to see your mom, which I happen to, I do love to see her, then when I go to see her, it's not, you know, I feel really clear, and she knows that I'm there to see her because I love her. So it's the same if you're trying to, like, get out of your car because you're feeling guilty or feeling obligated. It's not going to be that good. If you love riding your bike, which I do, I love being out of the car. I love smelling the fresh air. I love, you know, stopping and talking to my neighbors or, you know, paying attention to the creeks and how high they're flowing this time of the year and seeing what is the newest flower that just came out of the earth, you know. So then I'm on the bike. I'm not a martyr, say, riding the bike out of feeling this martyrdom and, like, cursing at the cars.
Oh, that would be that would be a bad situation, yeah.
It's just terrible for you and for everyone around you.
Sure.
Because, if you know, I've been in the environmental movement for 20 years, and I did have a point, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when I was angry. And I think, you know, if you're young, you have every right to be angry at what we're doing to this planet. But it didn't work for me for long term. I couldn't stay angry and stay healthy. And then people would see me on the road, on the sidewalk, and they would walk down the alley so they wouldn't have to confront me because I'd give them a lecture about, you know, the earth.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, and you go home and you try to give your family a lecture, and then they just roll their eyes, and they don't want to hear it, you know. And so 10 years ago or more, I stopped giving lectures to my family. And as an example, like this last family gathering we had, my brother's wife came and brought a napkin, cloth napkin for everyone with their name embroidered on it, you know, and no one asked her to do it. And, you know, in that house, when you typically go there for a family gathering, it's the woman that may bring out the plastic forks and the paper plates. And I didn't say anything about it when I went there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now you go there, there's no paper plates and no forks, and we have cloth napkins. And I haven't given them one lecture. They kind of watch and observe. They've read my book, and I'm not trying to force them to read it. They read it because they were interested in what their brother was up to.
Yeah, surely. Well, you know, again, it's. I'm thinking you say it's coming from all parts of the political and religious spectrum right now. I'm thinking of Matthew Scully, who was and may still be, as far as I know, a speechwriter for President Bush, and he grew up in Columbus here. And he read a book called Dominion. And Matthew Scully says, look, we have dominion over the animals of this earth. He takes it in a Christian tradition, and he said we are abusing them in the factory farm process. And he goes to the various factory farms. He shows you what goes on there. And he finally wound up, as a matter of fact, last time I talked to him, he became a vegan because he felt that not only, according to his biblical precept, not only should you not abuse the animals, but you shouldn't kill them either.
Yeah.
And not everybody is going to agree with that. But as you say, this concern for the earth, the animals on it, is coming from all places right now, many, many different places.
Yeah.
By the way, Jim Merkel is once again our guest here. Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth. We're at 614-292-8513. Just want to say that Jim is in town here this Friday and Saturday, the 16th and 17th, at a Sustainability Now conference sponsored by Simply Living, by the Social Responsibility Initiative of The Ohio State University and the Columbus Green Building Forum. Jim speaks Friday night at 7 o'clock at the new 4-H Center on Fred Taylor Drive on campus. And then there's the Saturday program. You can register either for the Friday night program or for the whole conference. And a previous caller suggested if you just Google Sustainability Now, Columbus, Ohio, you'd come up with the registration information. Let me give you the full web address, though, just in case. http://sri.osu.edu/sustainabilitynow. That's sri.osu.edu/sustainabilitynow for registration information for either just the lecture by Jim on Friday evening or for the whole conference. And if you'd like to call us now, tell us what you're doing in your life. How does this resonate with you, everything that Jim is saying on the show today? We're at 614-292-8513. And you can email a question or comment to openline@wosu.org. So, Jim, getting back to some of the concepts in Radical Simplicity, you say a tamed appetite is the core of global living. And you talk about how – and I think there's a great deal of truth in this. Our whole advertising culture and more than our advertising culture is geared to us consuming more, buying more stuff. And it's very seductive, very addictive, huh?
That doesn't end easy. I think it is such a culture. Say, if you graduate high school, you've seen 200,000 or more TV commercials.
Yeah.
You don't erase that overnight. But I think that once youth or anyone really starts to understand that what we have in our homes and what our neighbors have and what's up and down the street is basically everything that's been on the marketed to us, and our lives are pretty much dominated in the end by what is on the television, what's being marketed at us. And you could say, well, it doesn't work on me, but most of us it does.
You know, what happens, though, if let's say great numbers of people were to follow your suggestions and radically reduce the amount they consume, right?
Yeah.
What would happen to the economy?
I think it would be the greatest thing. And, you know, I got hired by Dartmouth College and worked there 2 years as their sustainability coordinator. And it's in no one's best interest to have an oil – their oil bill went in from $4 to $7 million in 1 year.
Wow.
Just because of the rising cost of oil, and plus they hadn't done their conservation homework. So, you know, while every nation on earth signed Kyoto except the U.S., you know, they were calling for 7% below 1990 levels by 2012. Well, we were 60% above at Dartmouth. Or 1990 level, 60% above. Now, there's a business called Interface Carpets who is one of the largest manufacturers of industrial carpets on earth, and he's 60% below his targets because he did radical sustainability in action. So from a business perspective, there's nothing makes more sense than being very conservative with waste, for instance. Everything you waste, you throw out in the landfill that could have been recycled into a useful input is waste. So this factory got, basically what they do is they lease out the carpets. So when you are finished with your carpet, they'll take it back and refabricate that exact material into new carpeting. So there's no effluent is their goal. And the goal of this corporation is to have all their energy come from the sun and wind and water, water power. So they would have no new energy and no new resources being taken from the Earth's crust and no effluent. Now, he's gotten so far, he's reduced his landfill waste by 70% since 1996. This is a large corporation. So, you know, what I'm seeing is from coast to coast, campuses are hiring sustainability coordinators because they see their oil bills. They have building projects in the pipeline right now, say at Dartmouth, $200 million building projects. When they go to buy that steel, that glass, that spray foam, that concrete, and it's 5 years down the road, and they've been planning this building, and now oil is $150 a barrel. When they were planning, it was $60. The main driver to the cost of all those inputs is energy. So they're going to have overruns like you won't even believe.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's why right now business is on board, higher ed is on board. Their ears are just so huge for sustainability. Everywhere I'm going now, you know, it doesn't matter what political bent you have. Wasting money is not in anyone's best interest. When you're just wasting your money when you're not paying attention to the flow of resources. And it worked fine when we thought the Earth was infinite. So for our economy, as we spend less, some businesses are going to have to go away, and that's a good thing. When you're stopping building bombs and stopping, you know, paving more and more and more of the earth, or stopping building factories that make trivial things that no one needs more widgets, those jobs not being there is a great thing. We should celebrate and have a party, but then what do we do with so people can work less if you have less needs? And, you know, I've been able to figure out how to work a lot less, what maybe not this radical for some others, but if you can work 30 hours instead of 60, you know, some people work 50, 60 hours.
Sure.
A week. I was working 60 at Dartmouth, so I understand what happens to people, and you know, I get crazy too and want to overwork.
Well, you know, when you talk about waste, I'm thinking of the Ford Motor Company, which is working with the architect and futurist William McDonough. They want to produce a car, every part of which has a little laser tag on it that tells you precisely what it's made of. I mean, every part of the car, so that you return it to the Ford Motor Company and they recycle all the materials and use them in the new production of the new car so that there's absolutely no waste generated at all. I mean, it's economically, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And of course, in terms of the earth, it makes a great deal of sense at all. You don't have to mine any new, you don't have to produce any new materials.
Right.
And they're really working hard to do that. Our next caller here is Glenn. Hello, Glenn, you're on the air.
Hi, years ago, there was a professor at Dartmouth named Dennis Meadows. I got a chance to meet him. He was part of a group that wrote a book called Limits to Growth. And a lot of people made fun of it because the predictions that they made didn't come true. But I think that's in part due to the fact that we made changes over the years since then. In effect, we heeded the warning that they made then, and we have pushed some of those predictions farther into the future. But do you know anything about Dennis? Is he still around?
He's at UNH right now, and at University of New Hampshire, and he's got his own institute there. His wife, Danella, who also co-authored with him, she did pass away about maybe 4 years ago, but she has an institute called the Sustainability Institute. It's right near me, so in Vermont, and if you look up Sustainability Institute, and, you know, her work continues with a staff of 12 people, I think, in Vermont, carrying on her work. And she did publish a book called Beyond the Limits in, I think it was 1994-ish, and showing that basically the three things that we haven't done, you know, since the models were created in the 1970 model in this book, Limits to Growth, what it did is modeled the world, our population, the resources, and our consumption. and industrial outputs. And it predicted we'd have serious crashes if we didn't change. And if you look at the models today, they're actually, we're very much on the steep curve because population has not been tamed yet. So we're going to 9 to 10 billion. And back then when it was written, we were probably at 2.5 billion. So we've tripled the population in that time frame. And then our industrial output has continued to rise dramatically. So these two things, basically industrial output is another word for consumerism, consumption. So population and consumption have been on exponential growth curves.
So
go ahead.
Well, my fear is that kind of like in the stock market, that nature is going to make a slight correction.
Yes,
and we're not going to have 9-10 billion people.
Well, I hate to personally, I don't want to bank that. Some of us can be very, very wealthy. The gap between the wealthy and the poor now, poorest billion on Earth, is 250 to 1. So we can, through military and being, keep ourselves quite protected and isolated while huge mass of people stay in poverty and supposedly let them die out. For me, it's not a very compassionate project that I don't want to be involved in personally. So, but there is a way to actually have a sustainable future. In Danella and Dennis's book, they do say three things need to be done. One is stabilize population. Two is stabilize consumption. And three is use technology efficiently. And the thing is, we haven't done any of those three, because you see our fleet miles per gallon have not, they've gone down since 1970. So we're being less efficient with resources. We're still growing in our consumerism globally, and we're growing people, populations. So those three things of the model are still out of control, and we haven't tamed them. That's what the sustainability movement is really trying to get us to do.
Yeah. Glenn, thanks for your call. Just got a couple of minutes left. You know, you make the point, an accurate one, that, Jim, that we, most of us in America, not everybody, live in a kind of comfort zone that is unknown to billions of people around the planet. And how do you see that changing? In other words, we have this huge amount of resources. We can make these choices about whether to have one car or two cars, or whether to fly transcontinent to see somebody in the family, whereas billions of people live in absolute poverty. How would that change?
We need to eradicate poverty worldwide. And UNICEF has put a price tag on it a few years ago when I wrote my book. I did the research, but it was $40 billion would eliminate the worst of the worst of poverty for the poorest billion. Well, we spend $700 billion on warfare, as an example. We spend $40 billion just on diets in America to reduce our caloric intake. And obesity is overtaking, say, tobacco as the leading cause of death, possibly this year. So we have so much waste in the system that we could assist with eradicating poverty immediately. Instead, though, we are kind of using the lower hemisphere, the southern hemisphere, as our new, when we call it outsourcing, it's a code word for getting cheap labor, and it's a neo-slavery in a sense. When you really look closely at what's happening, there's sweatshops and 14-year-old girls will make cheap products. So instead of having a policy that is what is good for the U.S., because I worked as an arms dealer for, 4 or 5 years for the U.S. military, and we had we were saying what is good for the U.S., and I'm saying what is good for all. I mean, that's a Christian principle in essence, but it's I don't put it forward as a Christian principle for me. For me, it's just that's just being a decent human being. It's to not say what is best for me. It's for me to say what is best for everyone. And when you go through life with that philosophy, you're not taking advantage of other people. And so, if I take advantage of people in my community and I'm a business person, no one's going to go to my business after a while because that person is not trustworthy. And then if we're a global player and we are the ones with the biggest impact, we have the most wealth of any nation on earth, we have the most weaponry, and we're using it to still get more wealth, there's a point where we don't have an ethical high road to stand on.
Jim, we must go at this point, totally out of time. Jim Merkel, my guest, his book, Radical Simplicity, Small Footprints on a Finite Earth. Jim, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great. It was fantastic.
fantastic.
Coming up next, Andrew Bartschmuckler. His question, have you ever been to a class reunion? He'd like your insights on listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus. Streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.